Hello and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 28 for December 8th, 2009. I'm your host, Dominic Rabier, and with me today are
Ben Snitkoff
and David O'Brien.
We've got three stories for you this week, as usual. First story covers Mininova and trying to get away from piracy. It's a torrent site. Our second story is the spy capabilities that are available to the government via Yahoo and Verizon. And our third story is the EFF suing the government for information on exactly how they're surveilling social networks. So let's dive right into our first story, Mininova. In August, Mininova lost a Dutch court case that basically ordered them to take down copyrighted links. They always took down links that were flagged by rights holders, but this particular court case ordered that they gave them 3 months back in August to purge all links to copyrighted content. And they tried filtering, they tried blocking and identifying them, but they couldn't do it. So what they ended up doing, and just recently, is they took down all publicly submitted torrents because they weren't able to review them all. There's just simply too many. And so they took down their entire public torrent database, and only their content distribution service, which I presume is much more strictly filtered. And I think it might even be a paid site. So the first question, this case, even though it is all in Dutch, why did they order Mininova to take down all links to copyrighted content? I mean, these are links. They're not hosting the content.
I couldn't find anything that really explained the reasoning behind the Dutch ruling, and unless I didn't read something that you guys said. I mean, so the Dutch ruling said that they had to remove everything that's reasonably likely to be infringing materials. Mininova construed that to mean everything that has a title that is clearly infringing and everything that has a title that is close to something that would be clearly infringing. The exact reasoning, I'm not sure. I'm not at all familiar with Dutch copyright law, so anything would be speculation on my part.
Yeah, so I think that they've had they've been doing something similar to this for some time now, where that I think you mentioned they were removing any flag content that, say, copyright holders were flagging as being infringing material. I guess the distinction now is this is a little bit more broad in terms of the way that they're approaching the problem. So if you think about how one clever user might be able to get around the whole flagging system, is just a cleverly mislabeled torrent tracker file. And rather than saying that you're infringing one particular, or not saying that you're infringing one particular, but labeling a tracker file to indicate that one work is included within it, maybe you label it something completely unrelated, like my research paper, which just happens to be 3.8 gigabytes, or something along those lines. And that way it makes it a little bit difficult for some of the content holders to actually find the works themselves and flag them. They would need to kind of go over all torrent tracker files, download them all, figure out which ones were their content, which ones should be flagged, which ones shouldn't be flagged, et cetera, and so forth. And it just seems like a whole mess of problems that both sides would have to deal with in order to properly comply with, for one, Mininova's new policies of removing the infringing content under the Dutch decision, and as well as the requirement for them to remove all flagged material.
So I translated the summary of the Dutch decision, and basically the court reasoned, as we might imagine it would, that even though Mininova doesn't host the content itself, it makes it far easier for users to find it, to commercially produced films, games, music, and TV shows that normally aren't given away for free. But because Mininova allows users to submit torrents that point to these things, it makes it a lot easier for them to obtain this copyrighted material and direct harm to copyright holders. That seems to be something the court focuses in on. But the new content distribution service, which Mininova, I think, started in 2007 and actually allows people to host content for free legally, as long as, because they're the content publisher is the one who's putting it up. But I don't think we'll be seeing the movie studios taking advantage of that anytime soon. Mininova.
Just a real question that I have is it even relevant anymore in terms of legal content? What do you guys think?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question? Relevant.
Do you guys think that BitTorrent is relevant anymore in terms of legal content? I think that it has been painted with with a brush that makes anything and everything under the sun that is BitTorrent just seem bad altogether. It's gotten a bad rap from the ISPs. It's got a bad rap from the content holders. And now I think that some people, perhaps maybe less educated people in terms of knowing what's what online, when they hear, oh, yeah, this is available on BitTorrent, they might stop and think, well, I've heard a ton of negative stuff on this. Why would I download something from BitTorrent? It might not be legal to do that.
Well, let me check some numbers for you. Checking a popular BitTorrent tracker, the latest episode of Ugly Betty currently has 2,700 seeders and 1,500 leechers. The most recent episode of Numbers has 2,500 seeders and almost 1,000 leechers. And the most recent episode of a Doctor Who cartoon that aired in the UK has almost 3,000 seeders and nearly 1,500 people leeching it currently. So, I mean, those aren't huge numbers, but it's a sizable number of people who are still using BitTorrent, despite the fact that, you know,
well, they're using it for, as you indicated, they're using it there to share copyrighted content. Those weren't, as far as I could tell, authorized downloads.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. You're saying how useful is BitTorrent for content that's legally obtained,
right,
and legally distributed?
Right.
World of Warcraft distribute their updates either on a BitTorrent network or on something that's essentially a BitTorrent network?
They do. They basically package their tracker inside. They basically package a little torrent client and distribute that. And
yeah,
the tracker is packaged inside. People can extract the tracker later if they want to use a separate client, but they basically package their own little torrent client.
And Revision 3 also still distributes over BitTorrent.
And so does Twit, and so does certain Linux distributions as well. They'll publish their, you know, newly released versions of the operating systems they create across BitTorrent. But my point is, it just seems that the unlawful use is so overshadowing the legal uses that you could have for BitTorrent. It just seems to have made it a little bit irrelevant. And I certainly appreciate when companies like Mininova and, you know, I think there's a few other torrent trackers out there that Pirate Bay, supposedly, you know, there was all those news stories that talked about Pirate Bay being bought out and going legit, and I think that's like all up in the air right now. I don't know if that ever went through. But, you know, I don't know from a business standpoint, how useful is it to own a torrent tracking website anymore now that the majority of content that is distributed across torrent tracking files happens to be unlawful? And it would just seem to me that any money that should be made there is, you know, the user base seems to be inflated with unlawful uses, and so there aren't any legal uses left to it, sort of de facto from the way that it has been used.
I guess I agree with you in the most part. Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing that happened to Napster and the Nutella networks. The illegal uses them overshadowed the legal uses to the extent that, you know, most of them were eventually shut down. Interestingly, I don't know if it's because there aren't any trackers hosted in America or because the trackers hosted in America aren't big enough to have drawn any legal attention, but, you know, we haven't had our Napster or our Grokster case of a BitTorrent in America yet, where, you know, we've done a real legal test as to whether or not these were legal. And I think it's a relatively interesting question for BitTorrent as opposed to for Napster or for Grokster. So with Napster, with Grokster, the problem was that they were inducing people to infringe copyright. What was the holding in the Napster case? Why was Napster held liable for copyright infringement?
Well, originally they were using a centralized repository system that stored all the infringing files, and they were distributing them out from that central server out to users that connected. They eventually, I think, if I remember correctly, they eventually changed the technology so that it became more like peer-to-peer, where in fact you were
downloading from the hosted computers. Everything in one location, at least content-wise. They hosted the list of who had what content in a central location. There was basically the sort of big picture is at the beginning of Napster, which was sort of a central list of, let's see, you've got all these computers connected. You say, all right, Bob has that file, Joe has that file, and people would go to the central list and say, I'm looking for this file, who has this file, okay, and then they would connect to that person and get that file. And Napster, the decision is that basically Napster, I think, was there was an injunction ordering to prevent traded music. I'm not sure whether it was inducement or I think it was contributory infringement. because the users, the three claims they brought were that the users were infringing their copyrights, the music industry, that is, that Napster was liable because the users, it was contributing to this infringement, and it was vicariously infringing because of maintaining that centralized list. And what you saw with Grokster, they basically tried to decentralize the list of who had what, and this is where you had sort of super nodes, I think is the talk, or maybe that's a Kazaa term, but you sort of had there would be little network of little lists, in other words, and they would all talk to each other in BitTorrent, but the difference is there you would still have people going to one place for the file. With what BitTorrent did is instead of I'm going to go to Bob to get the file, you would get pieces of the file from everyone who is getting the file at the same time or anyone who is seeding the file. So there's sort of this evolution where you have Napster, you go to a central list, it tells you, go to Bob, get the file. Then you have Grokster, there's no more central list because they realized a central list is an easy target for legal challenges. So instead, go to one of these super nodes that are connected and get the list there, and the list tells you who to go to. And then BitTorrent, the final evolution, where there's no central list. Instead, you have tracking sites such as Mininova, which point trackers, which collect who is hosting that particular file, what seeders, and stuff like that. So,
I don't disagree. I don't disagree at all. I think that you still have these contributory infringement problems because you're hosting a list of tracking files, right, which tell you how to get the actual file. So I don't know that it gets that around it that much anymore as it might have, 8 years ago. Mm. But this is the other thing too, at least under U.S. law, I don't know that we'll ever have a court decision the closest we ever got really was Grokster, but we're not going to have a court decision which declares a BitTorrent tracker, unless they're operating under the Grokster model, to be entirely unlawful. I think what you'll have is that it will just sort of be sued into oblivion because, the majority of their uses just happen to be for illicit activities. So I guess, I don't know, we'll have to see where this thing goes, but maybe some clever business person will find out a great way to turn this thing into a legitimate service where it's commonly used by people to distribute legal content. But until then, it's a big question, at least in my head, how they're going to do it and how it's going to remain relevant in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is that Mininova is just not going to remain relevant to the future, as sad as that is, for a place that's now, distributing illegal content. People aren't looking for general legal content. They're looking for specific content. And if, the Mininova can't provide it, people are going to go somewhere else that can.
Yeah. And with the rise of services like, for example, Netflix's streaming service, people are turning to legal alternatives that are pretty inexpensive in comparison and a lot easier to use than having to deal with the whole BitTorrent world. So I think the best way to defeat piracy, and I've maintained this for a while, is just provide legal services that are reasonably priced that are easier to use, and people will use them instead of trying to go get piracy. All right. Anything else on Mininova before we move on?
I'm good, David.
Nope.
All right. Let's move on to our second story. Yahoo and Verizon apparently have spy capabilities. So let's take a step back and figure out why we're talking about this story. There was an Indiana University graduate student called Christopher Soghoian, I think. I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name. And he was curious about how phone companies and internet service providers charge the government to obtain records on your communication. In other words, when the government says, I want to know what David's been doing online, they go to David's ISP and they say, we'd like to know what David's been doing online in the last month, and the ISP says, sure, but you need to pay us for that. And this guy, Christopher, he was asking to see what sort of prices the government is paying to all these things. And the way he did that is through a Freedom of Information Act request filed to the Department of Justice. And the reason Yahoo and Verizon come into this picture is because they've intervened and filed an objection saying that they'd be ridiculed and publicly shamed if their surveillance price sheets were made public. Yahoo and Verizon come up with slightly different defenses or objection rounds. Yahoo says that its pricing information, if it were disclosed, would shame Yahoo and shock their customers, and it would put Yahoo at a competitive disadvantage. Verizon objects on different grounds. It says that it might confuse customers and lead them to think that they could purchase their own surveillance capabilities when, in fact, these capabilities are only available to law enforcement. And this resultant interest from consumers wanting to buy their own surveillance capabilities from Verizon would flood Verizon's customer service and making it incredibly difficult for them to do business. So, first question, is it likely that Yahoo and Verizon are going to succeed in these objections? And it's worth noting that other ISPs such as Comcast and Cox Cable have revealed their price list, and some examples from that. Cox Communication charges $2,500 to fill a pen register trap and trace order. And we might want to talk about what a pen register trap and trace order is. And then $2,000 for each additional two-month interval. It also charges $3,500 for the first 30 days of a wiretap and $2,500 for each additional 30 days. So, and let's say you just want call records, 30 days of call records is $40. Comcast's price list, which was already leaked a couple years ago, it's about $1,000 per wiretap, if not more. So let's first maybe talk about what a pen register and trap and trace order is and how it differs from a wiretap. Let's start with the simple thing. What's a wiretap?
A wiretap is where the government actually gets to listen in on your phone calls. The rules vary from state to state, and they vary from states, between the states and the federal government. But essentially, what you need to do is get a warrant and the fill out, well, first the police would fill out an affidavit, and they'd say something along the lines of, we've tried traditional techniques aren't working, we've got to be able to listen to this person's phone call. What'll then happen is the phone company will set up some system whereby whenever the phone rings, whenever this person's phone rings or whenever they make a call out, a little room inside police headquarters or the attorney general's office or wherever they want it, you know, lights up and somebody picks up the phone and listens into what's happening and they get to record that conversation. Generally, there's also a requirement that you listen to the beginning of the conversation, and if the conversation clearly isn't relevant to the investigation, you got to hang up and stop recording.
And what's a pen register trap and trace?
A pen register and a trap and trace, I believe they're the same thing. A pen register is just, it pops up what numbers are calling in. It's basically caller ID. It tells you who's calling in and who you're calling out to, or the target of the investigation. Who the target of the investigation is calling and who's calling the target of the investigation.
And this information is useful in terms of setting up a network of who might be calling who and perhaps tracking.
Right.
So why do Verizon and Verizon and Yahoo have said why they object? But why might they object apart from the reasons they've said? Like, are the reasons legitimate, Dave?
Well, yeah. I mean, it might actually be helpful to talk a tiny bit about the Freedom of Information Act.
Sure.
It's actually a very old act, and it goes back to the '60s, as a matter of fact. And it's overgone a number of amendments and sort of revamps to the actual statutory language. There's at least three that I can remember in 1996, 2002, and 2007, were probably some of the more recent ones. Anyways, it allows for anybody, that includes citizens of the U.S. and non-citizens, to request certain types of information from the government. And that would almost include all information that is not subject to some sort of exemption. And there are 9 specific exemptions that I'm familiar with under the Freedom of Information Act that basically say that this information is exempt from disclosure to the Freedom of Information requests. Including those, as you might expect, are classified documents, internal agency personnel rules, information that might be exempt under some other type of law, trade secrets or confidential commercial information, internal agency memorandas and policy discussions, any type of information that might fall under that might be subject to some sort of personal privacy law, and you've got some other interesting stuff here that has to do with federally regulated banks and information that gets requested back and forth between the government and the banks, ongoing law enforcement investigations, and also some geological information that pertain to oil and gas wells. That's sort of a mouthful there. Interestingly, so we got this story off of a Wired article that had posted, and Wired says that they're Yahoo and Verizon are separately claiming 2 different exemptions, and that's not necessarily true, because if you look at the actual documents, they're both claiming exemption number 4, which is the trade secrets or confidential commercial information, what they did to sort of distinguish it a little bit is they both gave a little bit different information about why they thought their that particular data that was being requested was under an exemption. And Yahoo cited, you know, they thought it would bring shame to Yahoo, and then Verizon stated that it might cause confusion amongst the customers. The same principle applies here. They're claiming that it's some sort of confidential commercial information, and that's what's going to be at the heart of this debate, is whether or not this type of information can actually be considered confidential commercial information. It might be the case that you could call it the pricing models that they use is so unique to each company that it actually is some sort of competitive advantage or something along those lines that should not be released publicly to the competitors. But there's another interesting thing about these exemptions, in that the exemptions are actually what we call permissible exemptions, not mandatory exemptions. So to some extent, it's left up to the agency that the request is made to determine whether or not this information should be released. So you see both Yahoo and Verizon sort of pleading their cases here. But again, I think it's going to depend on how much we can actually consider this information commercial information.
Yeah, that argument strikes me as a bit of a stretch, that they're reaching for straws just to stay away from the ire. I do want to mention, though, that Yahoo says that this information would shame them. That's taken from the blog post of the person who made the request for the information. He said he wanted to get this information to, you know, shame the companies about how much they're charging to divulge our private information to the federal government. You go, David.
So go what I said before about, yeah, sorry. So what I said about the permissible versus mandatory application under the exemptions here, there's an exception to that rule, in that I think all of it is permissible except for rule number 3, is information that is under other laws. So I think that the company tried to do was they tried to paint this as trade secret information, because that information would qualify as being protected under certain portions of trade secret acts in particular states. I don't know how much that's actually going to apply, though, to something like pricing information, to government disclosure requests for, you know, ongoing investigations or investigations from the past.
Are you still there, David?
Yep, still here. Next question.
Okay. And you're correct, Ben, that Yahoo's objections aren't that you're going to shame us, but rather that pricing constitutes confidential commercial information, and that falls under one of the exemptions of the Freedom of Information Act and the Trade Secrets Act. Are they likely to succeed?
I really have no way to gauge that. Is anyone more familiar with FOIA than I am? I mean, I'm not very familiar with it. I'd feel in the woods trying to make a guess about this.
I'm not either, and I really think it might get a little bit away from FOIA, because this is interesting because we're seeing a different type of information that's being requested here. It's involving private companies and their communications with the federal government, not just information that the federal government has by itself. But it sort of depends how you want to look at this. If you take the view that, look, this information is pretty important because we're looking at how much taxpayers are actually paying for the government to make requests to private companies, then it might be a little bit more on the side of government information than it is private commercial information. My guess is, if I had to make one, is that the Department of Justice is probably going to sit back and evaluate how much we can consider this trade secret or confidential information. And my guess is that they probably won't really consider it like that, and it will probably be released, but it's a lot of speculation on my part. It just doesn't seem like this sort of information gives a competitive advantage to one company over another. I did think it was kind of interesting, though, when Verizon stated that it would cause consumer confusion, and what the article in Wired sort of panned out a little bit, and so did the document that was filed with Verizon panned out, is that they thought if this information was released to the public would get confused, thinking that these services that they provide to the federal government in regards to investigations would then be available to them, and then they would start calling the numbers that Verizon has and get into the department and try to start making requests to get information about other people when they can't do that at all. And Verizon's saying, we don't have the resources to handle that sort of influx of phone calls and emails and stuff, and it would totally inundate us, and it would sort of defeat the purpose of letting the government make emergency requests with regard to information that's otherwise confidential within Verizon.
Yeah, that argument strikes me as utterly absurd. That people will see this information posted on some guy's blog and immediately think that they're allowed to do it. And furthermore, that they'll want to do it. I don't buy it, and I'd love to see what kind of evidence they have to back up that claim.
I would too, but it just seemed like they were throwing spaghetti at the wall to see if it would stick and to see if it would be done. But again, I don't really think that this is going to be held back from release based on what they've submitted.
It probably doesn't help their cause that Cox and Comcast have already published their price lists. Although Comcast's was leaked instead of being published, but reported, I guess.
I agree.
Compiled with the disclosure. So, all right. Anything else on this story?
There is one other thing that I'd want to mention. Just another thing that popped up this week. Sprint was getting so many requests for GPS location that they set up a web portal to make it easier for police to get your information from your Sprint phone. They said today recently, not today, they said this week that there were over 8 million requests over the last, I think it was year. Client information about where they were. And it makes you wonder how many of those are unique requests for clients and how many of them are repeated requests for the same client, but...
that's interesting.
Either way, more reasons why I'm happy I'm not on Sprint. Not that I think AT&T is any better at this.
That's great.
This is the same Indiana University graduate student, Christopher Soguin. We're linked to his blog in show notes. His blog is called Slight Paranoia. So, sounds like it might
that
be
that doesn't
a good
sound accurate.
Well, the Freedom of Information Act is really interesting, and I would encourage anyone to go through it in detail if they want to find out more. But it also requires certain documents that are held by the government to automatically be published in certain areas online, and one of which is the Federal Register, actually. So there's a lot of information that you can get already through the Federal Register without having to make any type of FOIA request. There's just other types of agency-specific information that is available, it just doesn't automatically get released, and that those are the instances where you have to make the actual requests.
Yeah, and on that point, Sprint actually said that the 8 million figure is pretty grossly misrepresented because it only counts the number of pings, and within the context of a single request to track someone, there's going to be a ping every 3 minutes, and since it's a 60-day period for the initial court order, that's going to be a lot of pings for 3 million, or 3 minutes over 60 days is going to be a lot, and that gets up to 8 million pings, or over a year, I guess. So,
wait, so that's the one ping every 3 minutes for a 60-day or a 30-day period?
60-day period.
Okay.
So
one last interesting thing before we move on to just about a procedural aspect of FOIA, and that is if the agency does in fact decide that the information requested by the student blogger is exempt, the student will be able to make an appeal to the agency and go through the formal appeals process, and that might also entail a lawsuit that might separately be part of that request, and it's possible that on the basis of the appeal it could also be released. So there's still a lot of time in between which the agency might actually deny and the information might actually be released.
Yeah, 20 pings.
And just doing some...
Yeah, 20 pings an hour, I got 778. Yeah. Is that what you got?
20 pings an hour?
20 pings an hour times 24 hours in a day times 60 days. That number was 28,800, and then 8 million divided by 28,800, I got 277.
Yeah, 277 unique individuals, presuming that they pinged for the full duration of the 60 days, which might not have been that much. But it looks like ballpark, let's say under 1,000 people were tracked, which is a lot less scary
than 8 million. Yeah.
So.
Okay, math nerds, let's just say it's a really large a lot of pings.
It's a lot of pings, but it's a small number of people.
Yeah.
Okay.
I feel pretty safe because I try not to do illegal things, you know, that often. Right. But but it's nice to know that it's 277 people or somewhere around that number, as opposed to what I had assumed, which was thousands and thousands of people who are constantly being tracked by the police.
Interestingly, in line with this story, the original note when we were talking about the Verizon Yahoo, Yahoo's actually filed a DMCA takedown notice for its price list because apparently somebody posted it online. And they've filed a DMCA takedown notice with the whistleblower site Cryptome. So,
wow, I'd be willing to represent that person in a misuse of DMCA suit because I'm going to say there's no original expression in a price list. What do you guys think?
I agree.
Yeah, I think I agree as well.
Unless the prices are arranged in some very creative way, a price list does not really have any original expression in it.
And we'll keep following this story as it develops, but we'll post all the links in the show notes for this blog. And we're going to move on to the next story, and our last story this week is the Electronic Frontier Foundation suing the U.S. Department of Defense, the Department of Justice, and three other government agencies for refusing to release information about how the government is using social networks to spy on people. The EFF basically asked for a bunch of agencies back in early October to give them information about what guidelines they're using to use Facebook, Twitter, Flickr in terms of investigation and gathering data. And these agencies, surprise, surprise, haven't released the information, and so the EFF is suing under the Freedom of Information Act to compel the release of information. Thoughts on this, guys?
Well, it's good that we just gave this huge overview of the Freedom of Information Act, because again, those same exemptions would apply to that particular type of information, and some of the more notable ones would include ongoing law enforcement investigations. So any type of ongoing law enforcement investigation, any type of data that has to go along with that, they're not going to release that. And also, internal policy discussions and internal agency memoranda also are exempt under FOIA. So that's another request that would probably be denied as exempt from disclosure.
I mean, that being said, I don't know why the EFF is so concerned about this, because my guess is the government policy is going to be, when they're investigating somebody who they think is on Facebook or MySpace, they're going to search MySpace for the person and see what information they can get that's freely available.
There's two things that strike me as interesting about this, and one is the fact that one of the key components of having a social networking site is the fact that people are going onto them and they are consenting to have certain types of data released to either the world or to some sort of defined group. And once that's out there, it is out, and if it's available to the world, anyone can go and see it. So it's not a big surprise that if you're being investigated by a federal agency, chances are they're going to look you up on Facebook, especially if your profile is open to the world and they can see your wall postings or your pictures that you're uploading or whatever. What might be more interesting, though, is if they are circumventing some sort of security access to the websites to get at information that would otherwise hide it, or if they have some sort of agreement, like we're seeing with both Verizon and Yahoo, if they have agreements with companies in order to get access to certain types of information, and maybe along the same lines, what they're paying to get access to that type of information. Than that, though, I mean, I find the lawsuit to be slightly unremarkable, because I would expect that any government agency that's doing a investigation, be it for certain types of criminal matters or for selective types of civil matters, I would kind of expect them to go after, you know, online social networking to the full extent that they could under the law.
Yeah. Without divulging too much, I can say that at one point I worked with a part of the government that had investigatory capacities, and it was standard operating procedure to look up people on MySpace or Facebook to see what we could find out about them if they were, you know, the target in an investigation or ancillary to an investigation. You know, if the information's out there freely, it's it'd be silly of them not to try to use it. I do think, I agree with David, though, it's a lot more interesting if they have some sort of agreement to get that to that other information. Because, again, people don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in it. It'd be very interesting to see if the government had some sort of super Facebook account that could, from which they could, you know, view anybody's profile. Or, you know, similarly, I mean, for MySpace.
Transparency overall is important. I agree with that principle, but based on the EFF's post that they put up on the deep links portion of their website, I didn't really get a good grasp on what exactly it is that general policy information of how investigations are conducted.
I'm sorry, you know, it, can you repeat that? We lost you for a second or two.
Sorry. You can thank our fine friends at Skype and probably my ISP as well. But I didn't get a good grasp based on the EFF's post on their website what exactly it is that they're after. It would seem to me that you know, if they had given some reasons that they think that this information is really important, be it if they had some sort of knowledge that something was going on that might be illicit, or if there were policies that were definitely unlawful that the government was doing, those are all things that are really interested. But trying to get them to disclose general policy information might be important, but I, you know, I didn't really see the need for a huge lawsuit to get them to disclose absolutely everything, especially when the exemptions say, you know, internal policy memoranda will probably not be released because it's exempt under FOIA.
Right.
It smells like a fishing expedition to some extent, but who knows? Maybe they're going to uncover something really important, and the government is going through my Facebook page right now as we speak. And they can feel free to do that, by the way.
Yeah. It's certainly, I mean, it's certainly plausible that there is a master Facebook account. I mean, Facebook can certainly look at all the information, so it's just a question whether they allow the government to as well.
Yeah, and it's important to remember that there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in this information, and that's the test that, you know, the courts look to as to whether or not a search without a warrant is reasonable. If there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in it, you don't have any sort of interest in keeping that information away from the lawmen.
Well, you might have some sort of expectation of privacy, though, if you have privacy controls up on who can view what on your profile.
You're sharing it with a group of people. I don't think that gives you a reasonable expectation
my question,
of privacy.
Like, let's say I share my profile. Let's say I share a photo album with just my friends, and I have 300 or so friends. Do I have an expectation of privacy?
No, I don't think so. So, for one, David?
Well, I think that there is an analogy there that says, just the same as if I invite somebody into my home and allow them to view a collection of photographs that I have on my desk, I still have an expectation of privacy in those photos, so to speak. If I'm doing that online and I have restrictive privacy controls that only say certain people are allowed to do it, it seems to be somewhat analogous to that scenario where I invite them into my home because I'm only allowing certain people to see them. I'm also consenting to Facebook and their employees so that they can see them, but I don't know that that extends that same consent over to third party on Facebook and the people that I have selected.
I mean, do you remember the pen registers that we were talking about earlier? That
yes.
Recorded the numbers that you were calling and the numbers that were dialing in? You don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in those numbers. The government can get access to a pen register without a warrant. They just need to ask and pay the money. They also just need to do that with the list of calls that you've made. There's no reasonable expectation of privacy in that because all of those numbers go to a third party and come back from a third party. Because you're using, in that case, the telephone company, or in the internet case, MySpace or Facebook, as an intermediary, you don't have any expectation of privacy in that.
Is that definitely the de facto rule then? If you use some sort of third party, you don't have any reasonable expectation of privacy?
The third party rule varies slightly depending on what you're talking about, but generally it's the case, yeah. If you transmit the information to a third party, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy in it. I mean, the exception being things like when you're talking to a doctor or, you know, certain banking information is kept confidential, but I think that's generally kept confidential because of statute and not because of the Fourth Amendment.
So if other statutes do apply, though, to basically ensure that there's some sort of privacy expectation in some sort of in some sort of data, then it would seem that it might be private.
Maybe, but I don't think there's anything.
Well, I'm thinking about the Stored Communications Act, which would which does govern certain types of stored electronic communications that are held by ISPs and online service providers, though.
Yeah, but that only applies to the federal government. It doesn't apply to state governments.
Okay, fair enough, but we're talking about federal government FOIA requests here. It's the Department of Justice, right, that DFS is requesting the information from. So it might apply then, right?
I'm not familiar enough with the Stored Communications Act to give you a firm answer one way or the other.
I'm sort of playing devil's advocate because I think that there might be some colorful arguments as to why that information might still be private. But the truth is I haven't done enough research to know the actual answer.
Yeah, I just don't know.
But in terms of practical advice, if you have something you don't want to share with everyone, don't put it on Facebook, even if it's privacy protected, just because even something as simple as I have a laptop, I log in my Facebook account, I walk over to your worst enemy and say, hey, check out this. There goes your privacy.
Indeed.
So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, that goes for anything. Any of your online activity, I think one of the points we always hit it whenever we cover lawsuits that go around these types of privacy issues is that you're not anonymous online. Things that you do online are always accessible. They seem to exist forever because data on the internet never really seems to get deleted. So if you have any problem with sharing something and having everybody in the world see it, don't do it ever.
And what brought about this lawsuit, apparently, is that government officials have reportedly used Facebook to hunt for fugitives and search for evidence of underage drinking, researched the activities of an activist on Facebook and LinkedIn, watched YouTube to identify riot suspects, searched the home of a social worker because of Twitter messages regarding police actions he sent during the G20 summit, and used fake identities to trick Facebook users into accepting friend requests, and I'm quoting the CNN article there. Apparently, the government has done all sorts of things. Should they be doing that sort of thing? I guess that's what the EFF is trying to find out, to see whether there are guidelines. More practically, should there be guidelines, like, or should the government be able to do whatever it can get away with in order to fight terrorism and keep us safe, to use the slogan or two?
Well, one of the best things about living in this country is the fact that we do have certain expectations of privacy that do apply to very specific things, and that's certainly all changed in the last 15 years since the internet has just taken off and brought us into a new direction where everybody's online, and it's not just within the country, but that applies to the entire world. We're connected with the entire world through, you know, wired connections and wireless connections and so on and so forth. I do think, though, that there needs to be some sort of prescribed limits. You know, certainly the government cannot have access to absolutely everything. One of the better things that we see as it tends to apply to certain areas of privacy and criminal matters is that you need to get a warrant before you're able to access certain areas of a person's house or get access to certain documents, or at least you need a subpoena, you know, in regards to a criminal investigation or a civil lawsuit. I think what maybe the EFF is suggesting here is that those guidelines are, if they do exist, they're not being respected or enforced, and we need to have them or have transparency about what's going on.
Makes sense. Just quickly on that last thing, used a fake identity to trick Facebook users into accepting friend requests. That seems like the sort of thing that shouldn't be doable without a warrant. Or do you disagree?
If a friend of mine wants to put on a wire and then turn that information over to the government, they're free to do that under the Fourth Amendment. If I'm silly enough to friend request somebody who I don't know, who turns out to be a law person, I think that's my problem.
Well, this is the other way around. This is a law person pretending to be someone you do know in order to trick you into accepting their friend request. Like,
have you read the article that they're talking about? It was a Boston Globe article.
No, perhaps you can provide details.
Yeah, no, I haven't read it either. I'd just be very surprised if they were actually pretending to be a friend of yours.
You know, interestingly, the professional rules of conduct that apply to lawyers in most states do prohibit activities like deceptive fraud. And in civil lawsuits, it has come up a number of times where people have used deceptive means in order to gain access to a person's, the private areas of a person's social websites in order to get information about them as it might pertain to a lawsuit. So, for instance, if you have a witness that's going to come up and you want to find some damaging information to bring up while the witness is on the stand, you could maybe go up to their social networking site, find something that's completely inconsistent with what they're testifying to at trial, and then use that to discredit the witness. Now, when you do that and you use some sort of deceptive means, and some states have even held that if you use a third-party private investigator to do that, it is still a violation of the professional rules of conduct, and you are subject to sanction as a lawyer. I think those rules are probably much different for criminal investigations and law enforcement entities, but you know, that's a little strange to hear that people might be using fraudulent means of trying to get access to you know, a person's social networking page.
Makes sense. Anything else on this story?
I'm all set. David?
Well, yeah, we'll have to see where, as usual, we'll have to see where the government decides to go with the lawsuit and stuff, and how, to what extent they're going to go and try to protect the policy information from being released. But I think, you know, I'm waiting for someone to like send me an email and be like, you just argued yourself back and forth 5 times during the last story on the podcast, which is totally true. I think there's probably merit to both sides of it, but it still strikes me as sort of an odd lawsuit. And I don't know. Time will tell. We'll see where it goes and whether or not any information actually does get released.
All right. That concludes our podcast for today. I'm Dominic Ruddy, and with me today were
Ben Snitkoff
and David O'Brien.
Thanks for listening.